Hello, hello, hello! Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. And as promised last week, we have a guest that is so Cincinnati.
Pizza, pizza, pizza. You didn't know I was going to do that, did you?
I didn't, but it was the perfect segue to saying, no, that's not Jason Williams' voice. That is my special guest co-host today, my editor, Burl Love. Jason's on vacation. But Jason, he just wanted to really sit down and talk with Buddy LaRosa for a long time. And so Jason organized for this for us. And as is appropriate, we are on Buddy's schedule. So I am really excited to have my first conversation with him, which is not to say that I'm not familiar with LaRosa's pizza, because we talk about Skyline Chili on this podcast all the time. But and Buddy could probably confirm this for everybody, LaRosa's comes into the Coolidge house at least once a week.
As in many, many houses across the tri-state, right?
Yes. It is just, it's part of our culture and our city. So I'm super excited about that.
I am too. You know, I met Buddy a couple of times, and he's just a living legend, right? There's once the likes of Buddy LaRosa's gone, I mean, it's how can you replicate – you know, that guy's story, what he's meant to the community, the impact he's had, not just with pizza, but with high school sports and boxing and lifting youth out of poverty and, you know, and of course the pizza, pizza, pizza chant that we now have to endure during Reds games, it all goes back to Buddy LaRosa.
How are we going to squeeze that all in?
I don't know. We're going to have to try. You know, and what's funny too is, you know, whether it's Skyline Chili or – you know, Montgomery Inn, where people say, well, that's not real barbecue. You know, it has its haters. And there's people that say, oh, LaRosa's pizza, the sauce is too sweet, or, you know, you can get much better pizza. And yeah, I mean, you know, once the craft artisan pizza started, it made like, you know, LaRosa's and kind of family style pizza look kind of basic. But man, you always go back to that. Even if you don't have kids, it's like sometimes you're just like, you know what? I don't want to mess with figuring out, you know, do I want gorgonzola cheese on my pizza or whatever? I just want pizza, you know? And they deliver. 347-1111?
Yes.
Right?
Or the app.
Or the app.
In today's world, the app.
They're in every neighborhood. So we're going to talk to Buddy, and I'm really excited about that. But we have some serious things to talk about too, right?
We do. You know, in each of the past 2 weeks, Jason and I have talked about possibly discussing Wendell Young and what is going on with his seat on council. But with votes like imminent and things possibly happening like right after the podcast records, we kind of set that aside. But at this moment, it really is weighing heavy on City Hall. So I thought we'd kind of go over what's going on with that.
Yeah, and it's kind of complicated. And this is a good place to talk about this because it does get in the political weeds a bit. And for people who aren't following it as intently as you and Jason are, it was a little difficult to understand what was going on because you had this council vote where there were no votes. Everyone who actually voted were in favor of removing Wendell Young from council because, well, you can get into that a little bit. But there were two key abstentions. They needed 7 votes to do it. They only got 6. And it really kind of exposed, I think, one council member in particular who – well, let's just talk about Steve Gooden's vote.
Okay.
Can you break that down for us? Why would a – explain why would a Republican who was not part of the Gang of Five, who came in as a Republican judge's appointee, why would he not vote to remove a member of council who is under indictment? The voters passed issue 2 to allow council to remove council members who are facing legal troubles. It boggles the mind why he would abstain and not be that deciding vote.
Everyone came into this vote with kind of their own ideas of what should happen. And it wasn't necessarily with the bottom line of should Wendell be on council or not, because that's – they weren't really thinking about that when they had to cast
a vote. Okay, so we'll circle back to that key point, but go ahead. Break it down.
Okay, here's what counsel was looking at. Should Wendell Young remain on counsel under this idea of issue two? And there, the Democrat members of counsel actually think that Wendell Young didn't do anything criminal. Not all of the Democrats, but most of them didn't do anything criminal in the idea that he deleted his text and he's facing this felony charge. And so they would like to keep him on counsel. However, there is this underpinning of if they didn't suspend him, then the state could possibly suspend him. And they think that their suspension is better than the state's suspension, because under their suspension, another Democrat could appoint a Democrat to Wendell Young's seat, and he would continue to get paid, which is important to them. These people are friends with Wendell Young. They don't think he did anything wrong, and they would like to see him to keep getting his salary and his medical benefits. Remember, Wendell had a widowmaker heart attack, survived it. And really, it was very, very serious in the fact that we didn't know if he was going to be able to walk again. And here he is back at counsel. And so they want this for him. But there are others. So Betsy.
So this is where it gets, so amazing to me, because you would think Democrats would want to keep Wendell Young on counsel. Like you said, they don't think him that his destroying of the text messages merits, the indictment or being booted from counsel. But because it's always politics, right? We're playing politics. They figured their best political move would be to vote for his dismissal, his suspension, I should say, so that they control the appointment.
Correct.
So that they can – and then also, protecting his salary and everything like that. But ultimately, it's like, well, we'll have to sacrifice one of our own to make sure that we can appoint the replacement. So at this point, we're not talking about is it right or wrong to have someone who destroyed text messages – that were part of an FBI investigation. Is it right or wrong? That didn't even come to, I guess, the decision-making process. It was how can we play this game politically so that we win, we get the advantage. And the same thing on the side of the appointed Republicans.
Now, of course, because under the second state scenario, they would – that a Republican judge, which is Ralph Ted Winkler, he would be making the appointment, which we've seen because there's been a string of indictments. We've seen prior appointments by him to this council. He's not necessarily going to pick a Democrat. In fact, I would say almost certainly he's not going to. And so they're thinking about that. Now, of course, publicly they said they are not thinking about that, and that did not play into their decision. They kind of had this reason and that reason. They didn't say that, but people are thinking that that is what they
want. Well, they are thinking. And, in Steve's defense, Steve Gooden's defense, he was questioning whether or not people who were part of the Gang of Five investigation should be allowed to vote. So that's where he drew his line, saying, I'm going to abstain from this vote because I think it's flawed from the outset. We have people who were investigated for the same thing now voting on this matter. But if you take a step back – just like the Democrats on council wanted to control the appointment, I think Gooden is playing the long game, saying, well, if this vote doesn't happen and Wendell stays and the state comes in, then we have the chance of getting a Republican appointee. So my question for you, Sherry, is the political intrigue here, if you are a hard partisan or you're plugged into the party and your political future depends on staying in those good graces, I get all of that. But do you think that citizens, average voters, have now had enough? Like, this council is so dysfunctional, they can't even enact a simple vote based on a very basic question, which now has this ordinance behind it that was part of issue two, is should council be able to vote to remove a member that is under investigation and move us a step forward in getting the corruption out of city council? It seemed like just a basic no-brainer, but yet it gets tangled up in this political morass. Have people had enough, or do we just don't care? Like, it's just beyond, like, we're done with it. We can't – I can't even anymore with them. Is that where people
are?
That
is. That is the exact sentence I hear from so many people when I talk about, like, what I'm covering and what I'm reporting. I can't even. We are coming out of a pandemic, and there was a little bit of fighting over the stimulus money, you know, but that – was overshadowed by what was happening. Like, how should we spend $292 million to move our city forward? And that kind of conversation was overshadowed by what was happening with, you know, one member of council. And it will, I did write a story, like, this is could very much shift the balance of power on council, which the irony is that the entire Gang of Five case is predicated on the idea that five members of council texted among themselves, and their conversation was, we need to take the power back from John Cranley. That is the underpinning of what was going on with those secret texts. And now, after everything that has happened, you know, there is this more conservative bent to city council that kind of really is in the John Cranley camp of how things should be going at City Hall. So it is very ironic. And this replacement really could tip the balance. I mean, after that meeting, we did see Gwen McFarlane, the party chair of the Democrats. She's been on the podcast before. I encourage everyone to listen to kind of like what her background is and who she is. I love that conversation with her because you just see her as a party chair, but she just has this whole interesting history. But she actually called for Wendell to resign for the good of the party. And just, it was really a stunning, you know, statement to see her say that, because you know she doesn't believe that Wendell should be off of council because of all of this. But here, too, she was looking at the politics of it.
Right. At some point, you're such a lightning rod that for the betterment of the party, for the betterment of the city, the ability of city council to function, it would be nice, and I'm not – this isn't just a Wendell Young thing. I think this is one of the problems with politics in our country today is that people don't do the right thing. They don't voluntarily step down so that the rest of the – in this case, city council can get on with business. You know, the fact that how long away are we removed from the original – Gang of Five scandal. I mean, it's been what, a year and a half at least?
Oh, no. This started from day one. The texting started day one of their term in 2018.
In 2018. And we're still talking about it.
And
with all the other things that needs to happen.
And every week. We're talking about it every week. It doesn't rear its head sometimes. Every single week it comes into play somehow.
Well, I don't want to go all Bill Cunningham on
Do it.
Throw the bums out. But I, as an individual, just speaking not for the Cincinnati Choir, but as an individual who cares about the city, it's embarrassing to me. You know, I don't want to get into the different personalities and all of this, but it is, I think, and you and I have been here a long time, probably one of the most dysfunctional city councils maybe in the history of the city. Am I overstating that?
No.
I mean, go back to Boss Cox era and all of that.
You are not overstating.
And he was never elected. That's the thing, right? He wasn't even on. I mean, he controlled things, but I'm just – it's – anyway.
You
oh, now
what?
I'm all fired
all right,
up,
I'm gonna,
Sherry.
I'm going to leave people with one thing because this kind of spins it forward. We did see the Democratic Party last night endorse a slate of nine. And if you look at the underpinning of the conversation of who – you're going to see so much about the slates and who's running for council. I promise that's not what this is. But the underpinning of their conversation last night was a council who could get along with each other. And, you know, I was thinking when I was kind of seeing it all unfold last night, that's the baseline we're at. Like, people weren't like, this is a council that's – this is what they're going to do for this city. This is – they're such good leaders and this is who they're going to be. They were talking about the idea that they could get along with each other because that's where we're at inside City Hall. That's like an – the underlying thing, like, well, hopefully we'll all get along.
Well, now we need to cleanse ourselves.
Yes, we do.
This is just, we just need to, like, take a breath. We need to, like, you know, do something uplifting for our spirits now after talking about Cincinnati City Council. And there's no better way to do that than to talk about pizza and Buddy LaRosa.
Special special guest time on That's So Cincinnati podcast. Are you ready, Burl?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do this. Welcome. I mean, Mr. LaRosa.
Mr. LaRosa.
Just call me buddy. I'm kind of an informal guy.
So my first question, and I'm jumping all over Sherry because she's supposed to lead this, but did you legally change your name to Buddy?
No. You know, my mother and father divorced when I was just, a couple years old. It was a different culture. My dad was Sicilian, and my mother's from Naples, and her people didn't like the Sicilians. It's almost like the Palestinians and the Israelis. So they didn't have a chance. So when they divorced, we went back home to live with my mother's parents, who were Italian, and they came from the Naples area. And my dad, there's people, they lived in over the Rhine area, and they shared custody back in the day when it was terrible when you had a divorce in a family. I mean, it's bad now. I mean, I think
just the social stigma back then.
It is, but back then it was really, really, troublesome. But Buddy, it seemed like whenever somebody would be around, they say, "Hey, come here, little buddy," because I was a little kid, little guy. "Come here, buddy. Come here, little buddy." And after a while, it just stuck. But I never really changed my name. My given name was Sebastian Donald LaRosa. And Sebastian he went to a school with all German kids, and you got the name of Sebastian, and they kind of tease you and things. So I dropped that, and I just went under Donald. Although on my will, it says Sebastian Donald LaRosa, commonly known as Donald Sebastian LaRosa, and then Buddy in there in the parentheses covers everything so that they can say, well, that's really Buddy there.
All right. So from what I hear, I have to tell you, so I live over on the West Side. I hear you're out and about all the time, so we don't want to talk about your will. It is...
Well, my motto is when you live and you have to die, that's part of living, is dying. But when you leave something, you better leave your will and leave your estate in order. And my idea of a successful estate plan is the last check that they write to the undertaker bounces. That's estate planning. You got rid of everything. You don't own nothing.
Now,
I've done pretty good on the financial thing. I've got all the trusts set up and everything. And even now my antiques, I have been an antique collector my whole life. And I tell all my grandkids and my kids, now whatever you want here, put your name on it because it will be auctioned off. So you have to be realistic and say, well, we're only going to be here for it's a short time. I've been here 91 years so far, so I'm getting a pretty long run, and I've had family members that hit 100 plus. I've had two family, an aunt, 108, and I had an uncle that went to 102.
And it's that Italian blood, right?
90s, so I'm coming from a pretty good run.
It's that Italian blood and all the olive oil that
I think it's the olive oil mainly, really.
Right. So what is your most valuable antique in your collection?
I don't really have monetarily valuable antiques. They're mostly sentimental, and everything has a story. In other words, I have a huge sideboard. You know what a sideboard is?
Oh, yeah.
That they would have in a dining room.
Where you keep all of the china and the crystal that you get for your big Italian wedding, like I did.
Well, anyway, I found it in the old, you don't even remember, Valerio's Italian restaurant. It was on 6th Street on the second floor where Boca is right now. It was an Italian restaurant. It was called Valerio's. Well, when they had an auction there, when they went out of business, I bought the big sideboard that came from Italy, and it took four men to move it, and I've moved it two or three times. Now I have it in a condo. I've been here for 30 years. But those are the kind of things. I mean, I imagine it's valuable. I never had the stuff appraised. That'll be up to the kids. I don't look at things at how much they cost. It's if I love something or I have affection for it, that's valuable to me. It's all beauties in the eye of the beholder. Somebody else, it's nothing but a pile of junk. But I have many things, and they'll be surprised when they'll say, oh, I didn't know that was worth this much. They'll find out when they have it appraised, maybe.
So before we ask the million questions that we have, I just want to hear the La Rosa story in your own voice.
Well, I come from the family of entrepreneurs. My dad's people were Sicilian. They always were in the fruit and vegetable business. They even had the markets that you see now in Finley Market. We used to have a market over in 6th Street. It was the 6th Street Market. Well, Grandpa La Rosa had stands on both of those, the 6th Street Market and the Finley Market. And then for every day when there wasn't a market day, he had a store down, oh gosh, he was on Freeman Avenue, and he was down at Pearl and Sycamore. He had those two stores in my lifetime. So I had the good benefit when I, you know, worked for him in the summertime. And then my Panero part of the family, my mother's people, they had fruit markets also and grocery stores. They all were kind of self-employed when they came from the old country. My grandfathers, both of them, they worked initially in coal mines down in Wheeling, West Virginia. Then they came to Cincinnati and worked for the Ford Motor Company up in Hamilton. They didn't do that together, but my grandfathers didn't know each other back in those days. They didn't meet until my mom and dad met, and it was World War III, because, what, you're not going to marry a Sicilian? That's like, you know, an Israeli bringing home a Palestinian. No, you don't marry those guys. Well, they were in love. And my dad was the Pete Rose of the day, only he was a boxer, and he was very popular, and he had an automobile, a convertible, my mother told me, and she fell, I don't know if she fell in love with him or the car, but anyway, the union didn't last long. I don't think I was 2 or 3 years old when they got divorced, and I was raised in a divided family from then on, so they shared custody, and my dad was a boxer and a truck driver, primarily hauling produce, and my grandfather, they had that entrepreneurial background on both sides. So I always, it was second nature to me, put me in a store environment and give customer service and, you know, carry their bags out to the car. And I was like an indentured servant? you know, I working out my fare and my boat passage and room and board. From the time I was 7, 8 years old, I was working in those environments. So when it's time to, you know, get drafted and the Korean War was starting, and I just joined the Navy, I didn't want to go in the Army. So when I was in the Navy, I'm stationed in Philadelphia, and I was in the Naval Hospital. They made a corpsman out of me. In 27 weeks, I was a nurse. So in 27 weeks in Philadelphia, and I was in parts of New York and Bainbridge, Maryland, at hospital shifts, wherever. And wherever I went, I'd run into pizza parlors going to town, you know, for a weekend liberty or something. And I see pizza parlors. I say, golly, we don't have pizza parlors at home. We eat pizza at home, but only at mealtime. So I thought, gosh, when I get out, I don't know if I want to work in the fruit and vegetable business. You work, you know, odd hours. You get up early in the morning, you go to market, you work late, and maybe the restaurant business would be a lot easier, and I'll just sell pizza. Well, that's where I got the idea. So when I got out, it just so happened at the San Antonio church that my mother and father, my mother and grandmother belonged to over in Fairmount. It's still there. I was in an Italian community. And my Sicilian end of the family, they lived downtown and went to a church down on 5th and Broadway. It was Sacred Heart. And that was their parish. But they always had pizza or spaghetti dinners. So when I saw this pizza dinner up here at San Antonio, where my mother went, and my grandmother and my aunt, they ran the kitchen up there at San Antonio. I said, by golly, look at all the German and Irish people coming here eating pizza and thought it was so good. And they like to have it, you know, during the year without just waiting for the festival. So I thought, that's what I'm going to do. So I was already out of the Navy. I was married, had 1 or 2 kids. I don't remember. It seemed like we always had a couple coming. We wound up with 4, thank God. But I thought, I'm going to look for a spot. I cashed in some insurance policies I had for my college education. And my mother said, no, you can't cash that. That's for your college. I said, Mom, I'm married. I got a couple kids. I'm not going to go to college. I'm going to go into my own business. So she reluctantly signed the paper. I got my initial capital investment, which was $400. I found a store I could rent for $100 a month up in Western Hills on Boudinot, and I own half of the street now. I say that humbly. I have our corporate headquarters there. It's our campus, I should say. I have our corporate headquarters there. It was a furniture factory. I bought that. And years ago, they thought I was nuts when I bought that. And our phone center is there now with 150 phone operators taking pizza orders for three or four states. And then a block away, I have our main pizzeria where we started. Of course, it takes in about 10,000 square feet now. And we have a beautiful big parking lot for our carryout orders. And that at one time, I had three restaurants there. I had the pizzeria, I had the Italian Inn, and then I had the wine cellar, which was for parties and things. And then we had a fire in 73, and then that fire knocked us out of the box for quite a while. I thought that's the end of our business career. The insurance adjuster said it would take 6 to 9 months to get back in business. Well, a football coach from over at Western Hills High School, his name was Ralph Greiser, came over. Everybody did, and they paid their respects. Oh, it's a shame, buddy. You're a nice guy. That's the end of your business career. You'll never get back on your feet again. Coach Greiser saw the debris and the damage of the buildings. He said, no, Mr. President, I don't see that much damage here. I could bring the football team over here, and I think I could get you cleaned out of here in a week or two's time. I think we could be back in business in no time. So he gave me a positive outlook. I ran the dickens out of the adjusters. I don't want nothing to do with you. I hired someone, some attorney to deal with the adjusters because they're chiselers. I don't care who's listening. It's an adjuster. The damage that the fire does is one thing. Then the firemen, they put the fire out, and putting the fire out, they do damage. So when the adjuster comes and says, well, we can't pay you for that because that was damage done by the firemen. Well, wait a minute. It was caused by the fire. Well, I don't want to argue with them, so I hired an attorney to deal with the adjusters, and I went about to get my business back together. And thank God for the football team at Western Hills. Next thing you know, the kids from Elder heard about it. Then the coach from over at Oak Hills heard about it. I had maybe 50, 60 kids. It was like an Amish barn raising. And in 29 days, I was back in business thanks to those young people. Showed character and class because they used to go there and enjoy the pizzeria. And it was taken away from them, so they put it back for me. So consequently, I made a commitment to character of young people, and that's why we have the High School Hall of Fame and why I have a boxing foundation where we're like a family to the kids that don't have families. So that's how I got started in business. And God, thank God, it's going into the 71st or 72nd year. How about that?
Well, that also explains, which not everyone is familiar with that story, why you've been so passionate about youth and high schools and the name La Rosa's intertwined so tightly with high school sports. And what a Cincinnati story, too, to think back. You know, to having, and I don't know if that could happen in today's, you know, climate with insurance liability and all of that, but to have all those kids from those high schools on the West Side come together and help your family put the business back together. What a great story. What a great Cincinnati story. I mean,
well, you know, Burl,
chills down my back thinking about it.
Bill, Burl, it's all about leadership and all respect. And, you know, all those things go together. And when you see these kids that appreciated my business and what little I did to help them, maybe I bought a mat for the wrestling coach, or maybe I did something over here at the schools. Because I came up through the parochial system, and they always needed money in the Catholic schools. And their facilities never were quite as good as the public schools. And we always had to go out second-class citizens. So in some respects, I got involved with some of the schools. What do you need now that you helped me get back in my business? Even though, you know, like Western Hills, there wasn't a lot I could do for those kids over there, but maybe give them pregame meals, which I did. Elder, we could do a little more because they were in, had a little more need. But I helped all of those schools because they helped me when I was down. And these kids showed that character. And any institution that develops character in young people, we have to preserve it. Because then the next thing is the leadership. Look for the leaders and develop the leadership in those young people that are going to carry the initiative so other kids can follow them in the right direction.
And that's a hallmark of your boxing foundation, right?
Yes, ma'am. We use boxing as a hook, but we teach most of these kids. They don't come from traditional families. Maybe most of them are single parent families. There's not maybe a strong male a role model in that family. Well, we provide that with our boxing program. We kind of teach the kids that the respect everything. You have to respect, number one, your opponent in the other corner, because if you don't respect him, he's going to, put a whipping on your stick. But when you respect your opponent, then you respect the referee. He may, you know, not give you the decision or the judges. You still have to respect their decision. So we teach them respect. We teach them responsibility. Then we have lectures. We go into vocations and jobs and employment. We go through filling out a job application, how you prepare for an interview. You want to make a good impression. You don't want to go there with all kinds of hardware in your ears and your nose. And, you know, you just want to look a little conservative and like someone wants to hire you and represent them. So we teach them all those things, even when it comes to in the street. Anybody that wears a badge or has a symbol of authority, to respect them. You don't have to like them now. We're not telling you you have to like them. Just respect them and show them that courtesy. And get through life without getting in trouble by not doing what is the common thread today of non-respect.
Did you start out to make it a foundation?
How I started out, Phil Smith and Mrs. Smith, they always had a boxing program. And I used to help them out because my dad, being a boxer, and I boxed and as an amateur, he put me in a boxing program. He says, you're going to have to learn how to discipline yourself weight-wise. I don't think I weigh over 145 pounds right now. And when I boxed at 129. I could almost make weight now, and I'm 91 years old. So it teaches you to get on the scale and not go overweight. Like some people have just gone crazy with the weight.
Well, not only could you make weight, I bet you could probably kick someone's ass too.
Well, no, arthritis took over. and I can't hang up my own clothes anymore. No, really, it takes its toll. I could do okay now. I mean, I could still, my legs are still good. I could keep away from them and dance around. They might get tired. Then I'd move in and slap them a little bit.
I know you would.
Strategy. Boxing is about strategy.
I know you would.
That's right. It is. And everybody has to have that strategy. Same way in life. You know, you work hard when you're young. And just like the squirrels that put away their food for the wintertime. And kids don't do this. They're not taught that. In our program, we have a work program, and we hire these young people after they fill out an application. And we usually hire all of them because we want to give them all an opportunity. They work in our special events. We have the ballpark, the Great American Ballpark, or we have Kings Island, or we have a zoo. We have several of those places, at the soccer facility over at FC. So, you know, they learn to work within our system, and they work for a minimum wage, which is about $12 an hour now, I guess, in our field. But if they show initiative and leadership, they can go on up to more. But that's the starting salary. But we put it in direct deposit. We also teach them how to handle their money. when can I get my money, Mr. Rose? I said, well, talk to your coaches. It's your money. It's in your bank account. You've earned it. You've paid taxes on it. You already saw how taxes are taken out of your pay. They didn't know that. That was a learning experience. And then when they want to buy shoes or whatever, how much do you want to draw out to buy shoes? $25? Oh, no. I want $175. I want a pair of Michael Jordans. Well, then we teach them, well, wait a minute now. You know, you can't afford that. You only got X amount of money in your check, in your savings account, and you don't want to take money out for just a pair of shoes for that much. So you try to teach them what you can afford and what you can't afford, and that's really tough. That's the toughest thing with kids, when you try to teach them what they want, and it's their money and they earned it. And almost in the long run, you wind up giving it to them rather than, well, it is their money. And if they go home and tell one of their people that they're living with, we're not going to give them their money. We don't want to have that problem. So we give it to them. And then after a while, I say, hey, how are your shoes? You got enough to buy another pair? They say, no. Well, you better take care of those.
So do you think that those values now are almost out of style? Do you struggle more now than you did in the past trying to impart those values that you just spoke about?
Not really. If the kids stay in our program, they become products of it. I can tell you we have 4th of July, we usually have a picnic, and usually, I don't know the park they go to now, but we provide all the food and we invite all the young people that run our boxing program over the years. I find men that now who were some of our boxers, I can mention too, Mark Miller and Ron Morgan. They're property owners today, and they're multi-unit property owners that got jobs working in rehabbing. Next thing you know, they bought some of these buildings that were in red districts that were going to be tore down or they were going to be redone, and they bought them at reasonable prices and rehabbed them, got in on the Section 8 program, and I look at them now, and I'm so proud of them. So we have kids like that. We have some that are in sales, the various sales jobs. And when we have these reunions, I go around with a clipboard. And as I say hello to them, I say, I want your number. I want your telephone where I can reach you. And what are you doing now? You got a job or what are you doing? And it's so gratifying to hear these kids that, you know, they found their spot in life. Everybody is a spot, but you got to find what that specialty is. They don't know, so they have to try a lot of things until they find it. They live to work, they got passion for it, and that's the whole key to life. Finding what you have passion for, not just to go through the motions because you make a good salary, because you will not be fulfilling your need, and one day you'll be living a life of boredom because you're not being fulfilled. So they got to find your niche. I'm 91, and I hope I can keep going because I just love what I'm doing, and everybody should feel that way.
So, of course, we've written many times. Your sons run the day-to-day in the business, but do you still go in? Do you pop into the restaurants?
I tell you what, when I pop in every day, I'll go in, I walk through the dining room, and I just love when people see me and kind of beckon. Want me to come over and say hi to them, and they'll tell me, you know, my mom and dad used to come here. They met here when they were in high school, and then dad worked here. I hear all these stories, and what is your mom's and dad's name? And sometimes I remember some of them, and, you know, or I'll see a group of people, senior citizens, maybe 8 or 10 elderly women, you know, with the gray hair brigade, and I'll say, hi, girls. I say, what's going on today? Well, this was our high school class. This is our little week. We have little reunions here. We used to come here when we were in high school, and we'll stop and chat a little bit. And those are the things I really enjoy. And if I told you, I have a young lady who works in our corporate structure who met her husband when he worked as in high school. They had both worked at La Rosa's in our restaurant. She was a server, and he worked in the kitchen. Well, they met and fell in love, got married. He's a firefighter now, and she works still in our corporate headquarters. She's an assistant to one of the agents. I don't remember. But her mother met his father. In other words, two generations met working at La Rosa's. The grandparents and the kids.
Oh, my God.
Now, that's kind of unheard of.
That is unheard of.
Maybe P&G it happens to, but not with at a pizzeria. Well, but we have so many kids, they'll say, you know, my grandpa worked here, my father worked here, and they it's almost like a tradition. But while they're there with us, they learn how to, everything a customer sees must just sparkle. They know how to clean things. They know how everything has a place. To put things in its place and be neat and orderly. And when they're coming to work, if they see any paper or anything lay around at the various entrances, pick it up, bring it in, put it in the waste can. Those are the things we teach them that before they even get to work. Because everything a customer sees makes an impression, and they have to look for that same thing. Then once they're doing their task, then whatever their task is to make the customer happy to the extent and give him value that he wants to come back. And because of that, we have about maybe six or eight people that are franchisees holders that started with us as their first job. And if they wanted to go into business one day and they lacked a little capital, and we knew they were the right, had the right makeup and, you know, the right attitude, we'd go into them with a co-maker deal. Now, if they didn't make it, they'd be gone and we would take it over. But we usually don't. They take them over, and they're doing great. And those are the ones who really they sell more of our franchises. We turn more down than issue franchises today. Everybody wants a franchise, but they don't want to make the kind of commitment that we expect. No absentee owner. You got to be in there with the apron on. Your family's got to operate it. So it's your family operating our family restaurants.
So what you're describing here is how this legacy and almost this empire came together. You know, you have multiple locations now. You have, you know, your products are sold, you know, at the Reds game, at the zoo. You've got a grocery business. Did you set right. out to create an empire like this, or did it just
happen? No. I think, you know, when you have mottos like what you learn when you're young in school, good, better, best. Never leave at rest to you. Good is better and your better best. And then in Catholic schools, they try to teach perfection. You know, you're not perfect. None of us are perfect, but you have to reach for perfection. So you reach for perfection, you're never going to reach it. But you know what? You're going to be darn near the top. Same way with being the best. You will be near the top when you're constantly striving every day to do better than you did yesterday. So consequently, in good, better, best, and then trying to be perfect, and you got a good product to go with it, and you treat people, the most important people in our world are our guests. The next important people in the La Rosa category are our employees, our associates. So we keep in mind our customers are most important. Then the next important are the people that serve them. Our assistants, our associates, our employers, whatever you classify them. And then once you do that with a good product, you're going to be tough competition, kid. Ask Pizza Hut and the rest of the guys. They'll tell you.
Who? No, I'm just kidding.
So you have just, on our podcast, put out a clinic on how to be a successful business person, entrepreneur. So I have an inside business question I'm going to ask you because we like to break news on this podcast. But here's my question. Who holds the key to the lockbox that has the recipe
for the
La Rosa sauce? Yes, the sauce. Who's got that? Who has that key?
Well, you know, it's not that big of a secret. I'll tell you what it is. There's a certain region in Italy that has the just right amount of rainfall and just the right amount of sunshine to develop the highest pectin. Now, pectin is the rich meat in the tomato, and it develops just the highest natural sugar content in that fruit. And tomato is a fruit. It's not a vegetable. And when you get that tomato, the closest thing to that is in San Marzano, Italy, okay? Now, pizza, 9 out of 10 pizza places in America, price is first. It's not quality. our prices, our pizza prices cost a little bit more than everybody else. But we use San Marzano tomatoes. We don't use just the cheapest tomato you can buy. What is the mark? What is the price this year on your tomatoes? Well, most of the tomatoes are full of water and acid, and you get heartburn all the time. And they don't use San Marzano. Well, we only use San Marzano. There's only people say, "Oh, that's all BS." But in California, there is one area that where they produce it, and that's where our tomatoes come from. And I won't tell people where it is. It's none of their business. It's our little secret. But the 9 out of 10 people, so they find out where it is. You buy tomatoes way up there, and you have to truck them to a cannery. No. We have them canned there. We don't put them in cans. We put them in plastic bags. We recycle. We don't use cans anymore. How many times people open up cans and they get slivers of metal in your pie and your product? Bad enough if you're in a cannery that is not as strict as California. You go to California, I mean, their workers are in white. They've got their heads covered. They have food and drug agent from the state right in where they're doing all the packing, man, and walking around checking. You go to some of these states, they look like they're automobile mechanics. I don't want to buy none of those products in some of those places. California has the highest standards. When those products are cooked and finished, they analyze, they cook them again. And the second time, make sure there's no bacteria in there today. So they have the highest standards, California, and they got 90% of the tomatoes come from California. The other tomatoes come from Jersey, or they come from Ohio, or they come from Ohio, some states, or even Texas. But they come during just certain times of the year. They only maybe have one crop.
So has the recipe been consistent all these years, or have you had to change it?
Well, you know, when you got those kind of tomatoes, you can put it just like it comes out of the kettle on your pie,
and you'll lick your fingers. And I got to tell you too, my niece and I have had this argument for years of whether a tomato is a fruit or a vegetable. And she says it's a fruit, and I've been challenging it. But now I'm going to tell her, you win, Irene. Buddy LaRosa himself is on your side, dictating that the tomato is a fruit. So thank you for setting
it. It all starts with the tomatoes. You got to have the right tomatoes. And we don't, you know, we go around to a lot of our stores with the supervisors. And, well, you know, people are on incentive. You know, we have them on profit share. You know, food cost is important. And, you know, we have a reasonable food cost for people to work at. We keep our food cost around 33 to 35%. You know, there's a lot of people that get that high, it's too high. Well, maybe we can, and labor is really the highest one. You have labor in your food, yeah, you're almost 100%, not counting overhead. So, but we own the property. So that makes the overhead not as expensive. So there's other areas where you kind of manage a little sharper than your competitor, and that's how you can make it. And then we're involved in the communities. You know, we get involved with the kids and development of different programs. And with our foundation, we try to help. Of course, we don't have unlimited funds, but we try to help groups of people that, you know, are justified and need a little help, and we have a board that handles that. I take all kind of requests and I hand it into the board, and wherever it is, we give it away. But one day we hope to have a good sized foundation. We're working towards it so that we can put it into annuities and things, and then just take all of the interest and then just give the interest away every year. But maybe my kids will do it in their lifetime. But at least we got it started in mine.
Well, Mr. LaRosa, on behalf of the Enquirer and the That's So Cincinnati podcast and all the listeners who are just going to be so delighted to hear you share these stories, I want to thank you for joining us today. And I just have one final question for you. Did you know that, you know, here I am thinking, you know, LaRosa's, they've done it all. Is there anything else they can do to add to the fabric of our community? And now, thanks to your promotion with the Reds, that when a Reds pitcher or when the Reds have combined for 10 strikeouts, at that point in the game, the entire crowd starts chanting pizza, pizza, pizza.
Right.
Think about that impact that you've had that, you know, I don't know any other major league ballpark around the league where after 10 strikeouts, everyone stands up and starts chanting pizza, pizza, pizza. So you've done it again. You guys are out of tricks, the LaRosa family comes through with a brand new tradition that's so Cincinnati. So have you been at the ballpark when that happens to witness?
Sure. If they see me there, then they all holler at me, you know, and I wave to them too, you know. I holler pizza too. But, you know, when you have a team that's all pulling in one direction, and we have a team, that's how you breed success. It's a team effort. It's not one person. You might be the Pied Piper around the table, but we get around the table. I got some dynamic young guys, and when we leave the room, we're all for one and one for all. We join hands, we make a commitment, and if anybody has a difference of opinion with someone, we settle it in that room before we go outside. So we're always together. It's none of this nitpicking and talk about him. No, we don't do that. We have one mind, one goal, one purpose. It's just like in the Marine Corps. When you're out on patrol, somebody is firing at you, you immediately take cover. Then you figure out where the fire's coming from. Then everybody says, let's go put it out. And you all go and put it out. And you either put it out or you go down putting it out. But you're together, and that's what's important. We're together.
Well, Mr. LaRosa, thank you. You are an inspiration, and we can't thank you enough for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, you're quite welcome, and anytime we can be of service, well, we're here, babe.
Thank you.
Or you meet somebody that, you know, say, hey, they need a little help, not necessarily monetarily. Sometimes they need a pep talk or they need a shaken up. To realize what they've got. It's not what they don't have, but what they've got. We've got so much in this country. And, you know, hey, I started with $400 and a bad name. I was a Sicilian Italian. You know what a Sicilian Italian and the definition is? All you guys want to buy everything wholesale. And if you can't buy it wholesale, you steal it. Now, is that the kind of reputation you want to grow up with? No. You want to say, no, if I can't buy it, I'll do without it. But anyway, that's our attitude. Whatever it is, we don't hide it.
All right. Well, I think that was as promised. That was exactly the kind of conversation we needed to have today about our wonderful city and all of the people who make it so wonderful.
I know. That was awesome. That was awesome. I feel good now. I feel much better than when we were talking about city council.
You know, there's a few of us in the newsroom today. So, I mean, if you wanted to order lunch.
Okay.
None of us are saying no.
I think Phil's nodding his head. That would be good. But then Jason would be really mad that, you know, when he's on vacation, you know, we supply lunch for the That's So Cincinnati team.
He is somewhere in the sunshine, and we are here where there's a Reds game that's postponed because of rain.
Oh,
he'll be okay.
It's so rainy. That is so Cincinnati that, you know, the poor Reds, they try to do a reopening day because they can be at full capacity. The world's back, you know, to normal almost. And then literally it rains on their parade, even though there was not going to be a parade. But reopening day was a chance to get everybody down, get the place rocking, and then it's postponed because it is a dreary day today as we record this. But
I went to the game on Monday. So it was my first game back after the pandemic. It was my first time in the Dora. It felt like the reopening day, to be honest. It was really beautiful weather. It was a great day.
I was there too. You know, I always park at the Enquirer building on 312 Elm. And I enjoy walking to the ballpark and walking through the Dora because it's just like – it's what a baseball stadium neighborhood should be, you know, a street that's closed off. You can buy a beer outside and walk around and meet up with your friends. And it's just – it was really cool. It is so Cincinnati. But I have another That's So Cincinnati
okay.
moment.
All right.
So I'm really excited about this. So I got a Christmas present from my sister, which is so cool. I have to share it because I finally got to see it. She purchased a brick from Findlay Market on their brick campaign. Do you know about this brick
campaign? I do not.
All right. So to raise money for their education efforts and the support they do for, you know, small businesses and entrepreneurs and their outreach and all that stuff, they started a brick campaign. So you can buy a brick, you know, put your name on it or put your, you know, your loved one's name on it. You could honor people. You can just put your name on it or whatever. And she decided it'd be fun to get a brick for me and Lauren. So she got a little note saying that the brick was installed. So we like to go down to Findlay anyway. So that was just a good excuse to go down and pick up some food. And, you know, the big decision when you go there on the weekend is what are you going to eat because all the street vendors are out. And, I mean, that's a tough decision, right? And everybody was sitting out. All the tables in front of the outdoor beer area were filled up. And we were walking all around looking for it. And my brick, me and Lauren's brick, is like in that walkway as you're kind of going towards Eckerlines.
Okay.
Where they have, if you keep going, they have, that's where they have like the temporary tent set up and all that. And there it was. I have a brick at Findlay Market. And I couldn't feel better about it because it supports a good cause. And I feel immortalized now. Right?
That is such a special thing to have in part of, again, what is part of really our iconic Cincinnati history, the market. What a great idea.
Yeah. So I recommend that as like if you know, for that gift idea for the person who has everything or you just, you know, don't know what to get, if they love Findlay Market and go down there, it's just a really cool thing. So now whenever I go to Findlay Market, I will have to walk by and look at the brick. And there's some interesting names on there. You know, there's some recognizable, you know, notable Cincinnatians on there. And then there's just average, you know, nobodies like me and people that just care about the market. And I think it's the coolest idea. So so that was my
– Did you take a picture of it?
I did take a picture of it. You know what? I will post it on my editor's Facebook page.
Tweet about it.
And I'll tweet it out. Yeah, I will do so. I was tweeting last night, though. I mean, we're recording this Wednesday after the Reds got spanked, what, about 105-1 was the final score.
After what happened on Monday, I was like, what happened? I looked up from my work. I was like, what?
So I got to – speaking of Twitter, the Reds social media people have been amazing this year. They normally tweet an image out with the score of the game, right? This time, they couldn't even bear to put the score down. It was just like Phillies – or Reds, or what did it say? Phillies, a lot of runs. Reds, not as many runs or something like that. They just couldn't even bear to put the final score on there. And that got shared out quite a bit. But it was just one of those just train wrecks of a game that you should, you know, it. I would say it begs for Major League Baseball to consider the mercy rule. Just like in Little League, right? I played Little League Baseball, and if after the third inning or fourth inning you were down 10 runs –
That was the same thing on Monday. It was 11-1, but in our favor.
Oh, but this was bad. This was so bad that, you know, the Reds pitched two position players, Alex Blandino, who's like been in four games now, and the last Phillies batter, the pitcher, didn't even swing. He just stood up there with his bat on his shoulder, waiting to get, you know, called out on strikes so they could mercifully end the game. It was just brutal. But you know what? That's why there's 160 games in the season. You got to have a few that you just... But we can't afford too many more of those, Sherry.
Agree. And you know what? With a full stadium, which is what we're headed for now.
That's what we need.
That's all right. The fandom, we'll get this done.
They know. All right. Well, it was delightful pinch hitting for Jason.
Oh, thank you for doing it. I mean, obviously I miss Jason, but.
We all miss Jason. Even Phil looks a little, you know, down and out that Jason's not here.
As usual, I'm trying not to bother him on vacation, but it's hard.
I bet. Right. Well. Thank you, Sherry.
All right. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week. Two more big guests coming up. All right. Don't forget to listen.